This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. This week, we're revisiting the theme of animal therapy with Bob Williams, the founder of Ranch Hands Rescue, an incredible organization in Texas, and you'll hear me say brilliant and incredible so many times probably in this episode, because I believe so much in their work, you know, and genuinely think about organizations like theirs all the time, you know, when I'm plugging away here with the podcast and fighting the good fight against stigma. It's lovely to know that there's so many other people out there doing the same. And so this was a very special episode for me, having previously interviewed Landon, a member of Bob's team, who heads up the therapy and clinical work that this incredible series of programs does. Incredible, I'm saying it again. And so, you know, this is revisiting a theme of animal therapy, which is, you know, still, what, nearly 2 years later, still not understood enough. I had that conversation with Landon in episode 213. And so I'd recommend checking out that one as well for a lot more stats and the research side of what it is that animal therapy can achieve with people. And in this case, how much the animals benefit. And you'll hear why in this conversation. So yeah, there's that episode 213 to check out as well from October 7th, 2021. And here we are on 299 episode, talking of episode numbers. And I couldn't have asked for, you know, a better conversation, a better re-stamping in the ground of why we do what we do. And maybe you'll tell from my tone if you've been listening long enough, but you won't, you know, probably hear on the audio. For the last bit of this conversation, I was sat there silently crying, you know, just welled up. And I'm not going to say that this isn't a hard-hitting episode. It is. It's also an episode that's so full of hope, and it's that combination that gets me. If you want to know what kind of TV I cry at, it's the ad when, like, the family come together on Christmas and they didn't think they could. Like, it's a surprise, emotive hope. It's the, you know, no matter what, there are things we can do for our mental health, for the mental health of other people. That's not necessarily what the ads are on about, but, you know, sometimes they're just trying to sell chips for McDonald's, but they can still get me. And I'm tangenting. The point is, this conversation was special, and this work means as much to me now on 299 episodes as it did on episode one. So with that all said, we'll get into this conversation with Bob Williams in a moment. I'm aware I've given very little background on what the conversation is like, other than how I felt about it. But, you know, that's evidence enough how moved I was. And something I have to say about Bob, he is a personal inspiration of mine. And I know sometimes people don't know what to do with that. I didn't say it to his face, but this conversation very much confirmed it. I don't say that about a lot of people. I say it about even less interviewers. I'm very picky about interviewing, you know, doing it this long for a living. But I also say it about very few people working in mental health, and I meet a lot of people on this journey. I think you'll get why this is a big conversation, and it was one that was even bigger when we were in it. Over-delivered. Insights, hope, inspiration. He's all of them. And as he wanted to remind me, maybe I can be some of those things too. Just maybe. So yeah, let's get into it. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Bob Williams, and I'm the founder and CEO of an organization called Ranch Hands Rescue. And my story's very long in terms of how I got here, all right, to do this work. But I grew up in Michigan, Detroit, Michigan, to be specific, in a pretty normal family. Mom was a school teacher. Dad was retired military. Five of us in the family, you know. And my dad, he was a good man, but he was a tough man, you know, World War II hero, you know, that sort of thing. And he raised all of us boys that, you know, from the time we could walk, we learned how to ice skate. I can never remember growing up without an ice skating rink in the backyard. And all of us boys, we played hockey, and my dad was our coach. And we learned how to box at six and so on and so forth. And that was, you know, pretty typical family here in the U.S. But my dad, you know, with his military background, you know, he all wanted us to start working at a young age. I started working at 13 as a busboy in different things. And if you wanted a car or you wanted something, then you worked and you earned the money in order to get it. And it was pretty much that simple. And at 17, I was brutally raped and I was beat. And I spent 10 days in the hospital. And when my father picked me up, he said, "You're just going to man up. And we're never ever going to talk about this again." And I couldn't process what happened to me. You know, back then, it was a different time. And there wasn't programs for boys. And you certainly didn't talk about the rape of a boy. And I didn't have anybody to turn to. I didn't understand what had happened to me. I felt that everything had been taken from me. And I felt dirty and alone and ashamed. And so I turned to drugs and alcohol. And I spent the next 12 years struggling with addiction. I was homeless by the time I was 20, on the streets.
You know, that moment that you've described of having no mechanism to come to terms with what had happened to you, I can see how monumental that was. And then in a way, it sounds added to by the backdrop of your family, that you'd been raised so with this identity that your gender, who you were, so much of your essence is tied to being tough. That's who we are as men. That's who we are in this family. And then something happens to you that so undermines your feeling of safety, your connection to who I am, what sort of things can happen to me in this world. Would you mind sharing a bit of that initial shock and what was going through your mind?
Sure. You know, I really just wanted to die. I had no idea how to process those feelings. You know, today, I still can tell you what he smelled like. I still understand the fear, you know, with him beating me. I can take you through every detail. And when you're 17 and you're still developing and you've been raised with this masculine, you know, approach to life, right? Where we didn't really talk about our feelings in my family. As a matter of fact, I hated my father for years because I couldn't understand why he couldn't help me. When I finally made amends with him, when I did get clean and sober, he looked at me and he had tears in his eyes and he said, "I loved you so much. I didn't know how to help you." And I understood that because that's how he was raised. And, you know, the military people and, you know, they're trained to kill and that sort of thing. And it's you sweep it under the rug. You know, you're not going to talk about it. And so when you think about mental illness, any of these issues that all of us have had, the challenge is there is a terrible stigma that goes with it. And when you talk about a young man that was raped, all of a sudden people look at you as being different. And now on top of that, I'm an addict. Well, I mean, people, they judged me. They looked down on me. They treated me terrible. They told me I'd never amount to anything. I mean, you know, the list just goes on and on. Those are feelings of helplessness and hopelessness. And you're in a place, you know, where you can't understand how do you get out of it. And so I went deeper into my addiction to mask my pain. And I really didn't care if I lived or died. I think that many of those years I just existed. And you wake up every day trying to figure out, you know, how high can you get so that you don't have to remember where you're at and the things that have happened to you. Yeah. Or the things like survival sex and those sorts of things that you have to do to survive when you're on the streets.
Yeah. And I want to pull in maybe a parallel, if you say it this way, with you and your dad there, where I think something that's often not talked about is this hyper tough approach to life, to masculinity, often is underpinned by a degree of fear in a way that unless you've been there, I think people can always understand. And in many ways, the military is a heightened example of that because that training is so drummed into you that you have to keep your guard up at every point. You have to always watch your back, everyone else's back, because the day you don't, the day you take a second of vulnerability is the day something happens and you maybe lose your life. And, you know, it sounds like you had that drummed into you from him, but then also I think a lot of people can relate to that, and a lot of men, this idea of, I can't ever let my guard down.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting you mentioned that. My dad was married to my mom for 55 years. And, you know, that was a different generation, the World War II generation. And so, you know, we knew his military background and that sort of thing. And, you know, my dad always told us that he was a cook, you know what I mean, in the military. But it turns out he wasn't a cook. He was a machine gunner. And when he died and we went through his personal papers in his box, we found out that he was awarded the Bronze Star and a host of other medals. And in all those years, he was married to my mom, the closest person to him, the love of his life. He never once even shared with her what he really did in the military and the medals that he was awarded. And so that's the type of a generation, you know, the type of men that they were back then. And that was, you know, drilled into them, right? You didn't have to talk about it. It's just who they were.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a way to survive the things he went through in a way, you know. But as you know, those tools often aren't enough, or at many points in our lives, they become part of the problem of when we have no one to talk to, then this stuff just stays in us. And, you know, maybe it is drug use, maybe it's turning to other things to try and ease that burden.
Yeah, it's unhealthy coping mechanisms. And so, you know, the most important thing that all of us have to do is learn how to have healthy coping mechanisms. In my case, when we talk about, you know, mental illness and stigma and that sort of thing, you know, I had gotten clean and sober at 29. I did relapse, and then I got clean and sober for good. I've been clean and sober now for 34 years. But at the end of the day, 10 years into my sobriety, I knew that I was not mentally healthy. And what I mean by that, Bobby, is when you have to sleep with a gun next to your bed, when you have to get up 25 times a night and check and make sure the doors are locked, the windows are shut, when you have such fear to close your eyes to go to sleep at night, because I was sound asleep when my rape happened, that's not normal. And so even though I was on a good path from my addiction, and this is why, you know, dual diagnosis is so important, I knew that I wasn't mentally healthy. So I went to the Meadows here in the States, where I really got the long-term care and the treatment to deal with my rape. And that was a fascinating experience because I didn't talk about it all those years. I didn't talk about it. You know, my family knew, but nobody else knew. And so that's when I learned that it was okay to talk about it. And when I did, it felt like somebody had lifted 10,000 pounds of pressure off my shoulders. And I was finally able to start to heal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would add to that, that there are people out there that it is safe to have these conversations with, no matter how little they are had, no matter how few examples we may see of people that have gone through something similar. And may I ask, was the rapist someone known to you?
No, it was that. I was working in those days, I was a kids photographer, and you'd travel to different cities and department stores and, you know, take pictures, and then they'd come in and try to sell you know, a bunch of pictures and things like that. But back then there wasn't key cards and that sort of thing. It was a key, an actual key. And, you know, my parents had always told me, you know, chain the door and so on and so forth, but you could make duplicate keys evidently. And so our people had duplicate keys, and I went to bed and I never chained the door. And I woke up, you know, in the middle of the night with this guy on top of me, and, you know, that was it. So it was a very unfortunate situation, but, you know, I was stalked, and that's the way it was.
Through the years of not knowing how to wrap your head around this, not having someone to talk to, you mentioned survival sex. I feel like that's something that a lot of people won't understand what that term means. Do you mind elaborating?
Sure. So there's so many things that happen when you're in this terrible space of not seeing any hope. And when you're on the streets and you don't have a place to go, and somebody says to you, if you want to come home with me, you know, I'll give you a roof over your head. I'll feed you. You know, I'll take you out, buy you some clothes or shoes or whatever it is. You do it. And the consequence, of course, is they want to have sex with you. And so you have to get so high, you know what I mean, that you can do it without any feeling. All right. And It's what's called survival sex. It's very, very common with kids today, especially, that don't have any place to go. You know, predators prey on innocent and vulnerable people. And so the more vulnerable you are, the more at risk you are to have a predator prey upon you.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I asked you to define it there because it is something that is so little talked about and yet is so common. And I think unless you've been in situations like that, it is something that few people can relate to. This nuance of the decisions you find yourself with, where it is not a situation you would have chosen, but when you are in a position of having nowhere to go, the choices then become, what is the least worst option in this dire situation,
right,
where I'm not sure if I want to live, but I also don't want this sharp pain of being out on the streets. You know, is there a way around this? And so you start having these decisions of, okay, well, there's this person and this person that are offering me a situation I don't want, but I don't want the situation I'm in. And one of them seems safer than the other. And so there is an element of choice, but it's an element of choice against all odds when your back's against the wall. And actually, the choices aren't ones you'd want to make any of. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Because, you know, when there's 12 inches of snow on the ground and it's 12 degrees and you don't have a place to go, then you form unhealthy relationships. You do things that you never would do, you know, under ordinary circumstances in terms of meeting somebody. You know, I tell everybody I'm one of the lucky ones because I didn't get in any trouble, you know, and that's kind of unusual for somebody with a history, you know, the way that I was. But I have a lot of shame and guilt over some of the things that I had to do with other people in order to have a place to stay. And, you know, that's just something that I've had to learn to deal with over the years.
Yeah. And you talked about the beginning of that earlier, of getting sober, and then beyond there realizing, okay, there's a whole extra mountain, if you will, of things that I need to deal with beyond the drug taking, which in many ways sounds like it was a symptom of certain traumas, as opposed to, how can I phrase it? I don't really believe in something being isolated, but do you know what I mean? That you realized that you were scratching the surface of what you needed to work on. And so what was that process like, starting to get help and open up?
Well, as I got clean, I wanted to just delve into, you know, trying to be successful. And so I took so much of my energy and put it into, how do I be better? You know, how do I improve my life? Because even then, everybody doubted me, and including my family, who, by the way, I gave them every right to, you know, they had every right to think that I wouldn't be successful because of my past. But at the end of the day, you have to learn to love yourself. And I think, you know, I've heard several of your podcasts, and I know that you always have all these different phrases and things that you use at the end of the podcast, which I think really help people, but most people don't believe it, right? So we have to learn to believe that we are worth it and that we are valued, that God made us pure and beautiful. And so, yes, there's things that happen and there's mistakes, you know, as we go through life. I have, you know, I'm a Christian, so I have no doubt that what happened to me then was the reason for the work that I do today. It was God's way of preparing me to be the best that I could be. But I was able to, you know, I was working every lousy job you can think of at 30 years old. And I was able to get hired by a miracle, by a Fortune 100 company, and a big international company. I started off as a sales guy. I worked very hard. I was promoted over and over through the ranks. And I had a wonderful career. But at the end of the day, I realized, you know, after that first 10 years, that there was more to life. See, this is so complicated when it comes to even relationships. It's not just friendships. When you go through things like this, the depression and all the other issues that I faced, you don't want to let anybody into your world. So you build this wall to protect yourself. I put my efforts all into my work and to be as successful as I could. I tried to be the best man that I could be, the best individual, but I didn't want anybody to get close to me, because I was so afraid of being hurt. And, you know, it's like when you're in a relationship with someone, you have to give them your all, right? I mean, the real true essence of love is being able to hand yourself over to somebody, right? To give all of yourself to someone. And I couldn't do that. I had to learn, right, how to not only have hope, that there was hope for me to get better from a mental health standpoint, but also to learn to trust someone and to be able to give 100% of myself to someone. And that was a very long process. Many people think that, you know, with mental health issues, whether it's depression, anxiety, all the issues, you know, body dysphoria, that these things, they get better overnight, but they don't. This is a journey. This has been a lifelong journey for me with, you know, counseling, all right, that has been, you know, gone on for years, with group therapy and talking to people and AA and NA and, you know, developing this circle of love of people who share similar challenges that I faced. And how do we help each other? And I don't think there's a day that goes by, Bobby, that I don't learn something, you know what I mean, from somebody. And that something that I can, you know, utilize in my own life. And so that journey that each of us are on, it's very different. You know, it's like I discovered this counseling program totally by accident, all right? I had a stroke in 2007. And one of my closest friends was Doris Roberts. Doris was most famously known for playing the mom on the TV show Everybody Loves Raymond, which, you know, plays around the world. We were friends for 25 years. We talked every day. And I was visiting her in L.A., and my face went numb, my arm went numb, and I thought that, you know, I had slept wrong in the bed. She had this old coil mattress in her spare room, and I thought, well, probably just because it's such a lousy bed, I slept wrong, and I got like a pinched nerve in my neck or something. And, you know, she was just as funny in person as she was on TV. I said to her, why don't you replace that bed, you know? And she looked at me and said, well, why? You're the only one that ever sleeps in there. And of course, we got a big kick out of that. But she called her doctor and he brought me in. He said, bring him right in. I'll look at him. And he said, Bob, I think you're having a stroke. And so they got me into the medical center. I got that stroke medicine. But I still had a tremendous amount of rehab to do. I had about a year and a half worth of rehab. And I have some scar tissue on my brain that it's related to names and phone numbers and things like that where I have trouble, you know, recalling. And sometimes I stutter. I always know what I want to say, but it doesn't always want to come out. But it was interesting because the neurosurgeon, the first thing he said to me when he walked in was, what's your history of drug and alcohol abuse? Because they saw it on my brain. And that was a direct result of why I had a stroke. And so today, you know, we know that we can talk to these young people, we can talk to individuals, and we can share with them not just what happens with continued drug abuse and that sort of thing, but the long-term ramifications of what's going to happen based on, you know, what it does to your body and to your brain. And so I decided to retire in 2007, and I wanted to do something good with my life, but I wasn't sure what exactly would that be. But I said, you know, whatever, the stroke was a real wake-up call. And I said, I'm going to do something positive. And I started saving animals by accident. And I was fascinated that animals that were different, like say, for example, they had cancer or somebody had beaten them or they were going to be very costly to, you know, rehabilitate, they would just euthanize them. And I thought, wow, this is crazy. So Doris and I talked every day, and she'd started a program that she was very involved with in New York called Puppies Behind Bars. That was a program where white-collar criminals could train dogs as service dogs for people. And it was very popular and very successful. And she said, well, you know, I said, I started saving these animals. They have special needs. And I'm spending time with them. And I'm thinking to myself, these are like me, these animals. They're the throwaways. They're the ones nobody wants. They're the ones nobody understands. And I want to try to do something with that. And she said, well, why don't you start a public charity? And if you do, I'll help you raise money. And she did. She helped us raise millions of dollars. And she said, you know, you could start an animal sanctuary. And I said, but I want to do more than that. I want to figure out how to help people. I want to figure out how to help people like me. And so in 2008, Ranchhands Rescue was born, and it was an animal sanctuary for special needs animals that were seized by law enforcement for abuse and neglect. And I said, we can provide a forever home for them for whatever time they have left. That's our mission. And we will take care of them. All right. And we'll give them back their dignity and respect. And will love them unconditionally, regardless of how different they are. And on the animal side, we've done amazing things. We put the first horse in the world in a prosthetic leg without amputation. We did the first ever stem cell transplant in the horse with nanofiber technology. We did the first ever open heart surgery in a sheep. You know, things that I'm very proud of. But again, with, you know, working together with other people, I always felt could be done, right? And all of us have the opportunity to get better. And this is, you know, I don't mean to bore you because I know it's kind of a long story, but...
No, I really appreciate it. And I see the parallels for you. You connected to these animals in a way that perhaps you didn't know how to connect to people yet. You didn't know how to see who you were in the world, what examples of hope were out there for people like you, but you found a version of that in these animals and didn't have the history of essentially not trusting animals. You know, it was easier to make that connection.
Absolutely. And actually, you know, they give you unconditional love, so it was better than people. Right? But I noticed that they were having this effect on me, and I thought it was a very positive effect. And in some way, they were helping me. There was a bond I was forming with them because it was just me back in those days taking care of them, you know, feeding them and picking up their, you know, poop and so on and so forth and giving them water. And so I thought, you know, there's got to be a way to partner animals in mental health therapy. So I started doing research on the power of animals in mental health therapy. And we all know that there's a tremendous amount of data about the power of healthy animals in mental health therapy with wounded warriors and with kids. And then there's riding therapy and, you know, the list goes on and on. But there's not one piece of data in the entire world on the power of abused and neglected animals in mental health therapy. As a matter of fact, we're the first to collect it and publish it. So here's what happened. I said, you know, I started reaching out to counselors and the people who were, I wanted to focus on kids that have been sexually abused because I felt that if I couldn't process what happened to me at 17, how does a 6-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 15-year-old, how do they process it? And so I said, you know, we can help these kids that need a different or more alternative approach to mental health. But every counselor I met with said, no, you have to have healthy animals. This is never going to work. Doris had a motto, all right? Her motto was, I don't give in, I don't give up, I don't take no for an answer, and I never, ever settled. I think we all need role models. Doris was more than just a friend to me. She was a wonderful role model. You know, she was 40 years older than me, and we had the type of relationship that was open and honest. And, you know, I learned a lot from her because we had a lot of similarities in our background. And so I just kept going and I would talk to these people and they'd say, look, you got to have all the animals and it's not going to work. And I'd say, well, you know, okay. And I just would keep going. I finally found this counselor. Her name was Kim. And I met with her and I went through my whole life story with her. I introduced her to the animals. I said, look, you know, I really think there's something here. All right. And she said, Bob, I got to tell you, you're a great guy and it's an honor to meet you, but it's not going to work. You have got to have healthy horses. And at the time, she was
which
working with
I just
kids
have to say here, it's so strange. It seems, you know, not just because we know it works and you've proven so much of that, but it seems such a niche perspective because already animal therapy isn't nearly understood enough. But to have this binary notion of like, well, if the animals are sick, the people are going to stay sick. I don't even know where that comes from.
Right.
Is it just me that's baffled by that?
I was baffled as well. So, you know, I just stayed honored. I said, look, would you just come up and try it? All right. So finally she agreed. She said, okay, I'll bring a couple of kiddos up there and we'll work with some of your animals and I'll be in touch. So she brought some kiddos up and she called me up a couple of days later. She said, let's meet for breakfast. And we met for breakfast and she said, I got to tell you, I really think you're onto something here. I seem to be able to get to the root of the trauma quicker. She said, Bob, I would never have believed this in a million years. But these kids, there's automatically something that's sensed by these animals that have been hurt so bad and these children that have been hurt so bad. And there's a bond. And most people think that the child picks the animal, but it's the opposite. The animal senses what's happening with the child and picks the child. And so I said, will you help me develop a program? And she said, absolutely. And so we developed this program and I took everything I liked about all the counseling I had, treatment, you know, so on and so forth. And I said, I'm going to take the best practices from a bunch of different things, because I don't believe that there's a one size fits all when it comes to mental health, mm-hmm. right? I think you have to, I know Landon hates this term, but throw the kitchen sink at it, because every single person is different, you know, and we're all individual, and what works for me may not work for you. And so I took the program to the Children's Advocacy Centers, and the Children's Advocacy Centers are the centers here that deal with kids that have been sexually abused, and they do the forensics, and they're just incredible organizations in order to get these kids healthy. And the executive director looked at me and said, Bob, I got to tell you, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I really think that this is an incredible program. And I said, great, when can we start? And he said, no. You know, I've got 21 counselors. I don't need you. I just think you're going to do amazing things in the community. You're going to help a lot of people. I love your strategy. But, you know, we have everything in-house. And I looked at him and I said, well, can I ask you a question? And he said, absolutely. And I said, can you save every child? And he thought for a minute and he said, no. And I said, then where do they go? And he looked at me and said, you got a point. And that's when our counseling program was started in 2010 on a hope and a dream. And it was designed for the 1-10% of individuals that need a different or more alternative approach to mental health, where we partner animals with them that have been abused and neglected. And so when you think about this program and what we've learned over the years, we don't just do animal therapy, you know, but we do EMDR and we do CBT and we do play therapy and sand therapy and so on and so forth. Because again, it's taking all of the best modalities and applying them to the individual for healing. And a very important piece of that is the testing. You know, we have to understand exactly what we're dealing with. With this significant trauma, with sex trafficking, sexual abuse, all these types of things, we've got to be able to peel back that onion and get right down to the core of what happened in order to help people heal, especially when this happens to children. And so by doing all these different modalities, the whole counseling clinical team, so we have a psychiatrist, a psychologist, and a complete clinical staff, then we can develop comprehensive programs that we think are going to help these individuals. And our success rate is just off the charts, with a 92% reduction of symptoms. And that's just unheard of really anywhere in the world. You know, what's acceptable is 60% of symptom reduction. And so, you know, we're very proud of it.
It's incredible work. It really is. And I want to highlight what you said earlier about the animals choosing the child, because I think that if people are unfamiliar with animal therapy, that's one of the things that's so powerful about it, that there's something innate in animals to find connections, to seek to be comforted, but also provide comfort in a way that, for a whole host of reasons, as people, we don't always have that, you know?
Right. Well, you know, and I've been listening to your podcast since Landon was on, and there's so many different things that, you know, that we agree on. But I think the one thing that's critical that people need to remember is that there is hope, and there's not this magic wand that you can wave to fix these issues. And we have to try different things. We have to look at non-traditional methods in an effort to really figure out how do we help people, because we're all different. And so I never wanted to take away anything from anybody that was doing incredible work. It was, how do I help the people that you can't? And then how do I take this program and share it with the world? You know, it's like the safe house. You know, we opened the first safe house in the world for young men that have been sex trafficked. It's mind-boggling that nobody thought of this before. I always envisioned my program to have a residential component, but I thought it would be for veterans. And I was going to do it in honor of my father, veterans that were struggling and needed help. And then, you know, I got involved in human trafficking. I sit on several task forces here in the United States. I couldn't believe that there wasn't a place for young men to go to. And nobody was addressing the GLBTQ issue. And then I thought, okay, what percentage of these kids, it doesn't matter to me because they're a victim, right? Are GLBTQ, what percentage are straight? You know, the majority of them that are trafficked, the boys, are straight. And so nobody's helping them. And the suicide rate is through the roof. And if we can't figure out how to solve this problem, these kids are going to end up in jail, face a lifetime of addiction, or death. And so I said, we can fix that. We can open the first house, all right? And the response has been so overwhelming that we can't even keep up with the number of calls that we get every day. So we're going through a huge expansion program right now because the number of victims is shocking.
Absolutely, yeah. It is. And you're working with a specific age group, right, with Bob's House of Hope.
So I felt the biggest need was 18 and above. The average age that boys are trafficked is 13. So you've got perpetrators preying on vulnerable children. Most people think that sex trafficking is like the movie Taken with, you know, our friend Liam Nelson. But the definition of human trafficking is the sale of human bodies through force, fraud, or coercion. So yes, there is a portion of that. It's a $1 billion a year business. But the majority of it, these kids are trafficked by somebody that they know, a family member, a friend, a neighbor, right? Because it's all about money. And they're sold 6 to 8 times a day. So for example, you know, we have a young man that was trafficked since he was 12 years old by his stepfather. They're horrific stories, all right? We have a young man that was trafficked by somebody that he thought he was in love with. The stories will keep you up at night as to how these individuals got to where they are, but they control them through drugs. And that's the bottom line, right? Is that there's fear, they're controlled through drugs, manipulation. And again, you know,
and just to add on to that, when you say controlled through drugs, you're referencing the traffickers will use drugs to get somebody addicted, to make them more malleable, essentially, to their intentions.
Absolutely. To force them to do the things that they want them to do. All right. And there's not one rational person that can comprehend the evil that these individuals have and what they do to these people. The stories will keep you up at night in terms of the things that they've been through. You know, we had a boy that was, and by the way, they're all branded. You know, the traffickers brand them as their property. And so they all have tattoos so that other traffickers know, look, this is my property. You know, you keep your hands off of them. And it's the same thing with girls and women. You know, they brand them. It's horrific. And yeah. One of the things that people say all the time is, well, you know, why couldn't they get away? Well, the threats of killing family members, the drug addiction, the fear that, you know, they're not good enough. You know, we have a young man who is a very good looking young man, you know, tall and thin, and his trafficker used to make him stand nude in front of a mirror and tell him how fat he was and how ugly he was and how terrible his body was, right? And on and on and on, you can only imagine. And that's all that that young man believed, right? Was that he had no value, that he was ugly. And, you know, the mechanisms for control. Yeah. There's not just one, there's hundreds, you know.
And essentially with what you're describing there, it is weaponizing mental illness. It's essentially creating body dysmorphia, creating drug addiction,
yes.
Creating all these ways to increase somebody's vulnerability who's already so vulnerable. And in doing so, create that control, because ultimately if they got away, where would they go? And would they believe that anyone would take them in, anyone would show them kindness when you've got the backdrop of that's how you've been treated across years,
right?
Even decades of your life.
Right. And I think that these young people, they end up in these situations because they've been groomed. And that's, you know, grooming is the techniques that these predators use in order to win people over. But because, again, we don't understand enough about mental illness or challenges that youth face, we've got real issues when it comes to perpetrators, you know, preying on not only our youth, but anybody who has certain mental health issues. And so
Yeah. It's
a huge challenge. I mean, mental health is, I think, the number one problem in the United States today. I'm not sure around the world, but it certainly is in the U.S.
Yeah, you're right. This is happening all around us. You know, if it's not sex trafficking happening around the corner, it's an abusive relationship with often many of the same coercive, controlling behaviors, many of the same abusive behaviors. And so, yeah, this stuff is weaponized all around us all the time. And so, you know, it's incredible that you do this work, but it's also infuriating to know the scale that you're dealing with. You know, I think of stories like this when, you know, every so often you hear somebody, and, you know, you're aware that this can be a narrative that exists in the States of, well, slavery's over. That's in the past. We should move on. And slavery is not over. In fact, in many ways, it exists in so many ways we couldn't even imagine, let alone know are right under our feet.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think one of the challenges that people face is it's no different than what you've been doing here now for so many years and trying to destigmatize, you know, mental illness. This sex trafficking of boys, people don't want to address it. They don't want to acknowledge it. The myth is boys can get away. Boys are strong. Boys are tough. But that's not the case. And so we really believe
boys are told to be tough. You know, that's the only truth I have from that statement.
Yeah, I agree. We believe that up to 50% of human trafficking victims are boys and young men. And we have got to start having the dialogue, because when you look at the statistics, all right, and, you know, the studies that have come out in the U.S., you know, the Justice Department issued a study saying that they believe 36% of human trafficking victims are boys. ECPAT did a study, an international organization, saying 38% of human trafficking victims are boys. But both studies say it's extremely underreported. And so that's why we really believe that it's up to 50% of human trafficking victims are boys and young men. And even so, now, nobody wants to talk about it, because it's a complex conversation that, like mental illness, forces people to get out of their comfort zone and have a conversation about things that are happening today, all right, with all of us. And so human trafficking happens in every city, in every county, in every state, in every country around the world. And every 7 minutes, a boy is trafficked. So since we've been talking here, you know, how many have been trafficked? 3 or 4? So the reality is that this is a very, very serious problem. Yeah. That
and you know, I want to clarify even on that stat, that is the beginning of trafficking. That someone may even assume that that means, oh, you know, someone is being taken across a border or king, but no, that's when it starts. That's another person added to this pandemic, really. I should know the difference between those two words at this point, you'd think, having gone through the last few years. And tell me this then, with this incredibly tough work that you clearly have such a passion and a calling for, how do you keep hope?
Well, people ask me all the time, that's probably the number one question I get. It's not easy. I'm going to be honest with you, I'm getting tired. I have a lot of problems sleeping at night because I can't get these kids off my mind. You know, you hear the stories. You know, I'm not involved in the day-to-day activities anymore as the CEO. You know, that's run by Land, and I'm a very competent team. But I think the great news here is I get to watch them get healthy. And it is a journey, right? Our programs, or your program, to teach them a trade, basic life skills, you know, how to make your bed, how to take care of yourself. Most kids don't even understand how to brush their teeth correctly. They've never had medical care. So we're dealing with HIV. We're dealing with a host of health issues, you know, as a result of what they've been through. But at the end of the day, we can watch them get better, all right? They're what I call baby steps, you know, getting their felony convictions taken care of, right? Getting them a driver's license, watching their growth, right? And their emotional age increase, seeing the smiles on their faces, you know, when they get a good grade in the school. We've got several in college right now, they're all getting straight A's, which I'm really proud of, because, you know, they have a chance at life. But what's interesting about this is these are individuals, they're young men that never had a chance to be a kid. So when they come in, you know, I give them a 3-foot stuffed animal, Bobby, and everybody thought I was crazy, right? And I said, I think that they're going to love it. They all sleep with their stuffed animals. They love stuffed animals, because even though they might be 18, 19, 20 years old, emotionally, they're about 12. And they didn't have the same experiences. You know, they haven't been to Disney World or an amusement park or experienced the same thing that other kids have experienced. And so experiences are good for them. All that they've ever had is somebody taking from them. And I tell every one of them when they come in, no one will ever touch you. You are totally safe. We will help you make your own independent decisions, but those decisions are yours. Your journey is up to you. If you meet me halfway, we can help you. But again, these are all going to be your decisions. We're not going to act like a trafficker and tell them they have to do what they have to do. You see what I mean? And so far, you know, it's been very successful and we're really proud of it. And, you know, financially, it's always tough because we have to raise a lot of money in order to take care of these young men. But we're going through a huge expansion where we're adding an additional 35 beds. And, you know, we bought a big piece of property and working on developing that. But again, it's people see me coming, they run the other way because I always got my hand out and here to raise money, right? And, but I tell them it's, you know, to help these innocent kids. And so I think to answer your question, it's watching them get better. You know,
seeing that hope return, really.
Yeah, that you can get better, that you can have a great life and you can really be happy and content with yourself. And so I think that watching them get better is probably the greatest gift that anybody could ever give me. Because I believe with all my heart, we should be taking care of each other. Mm-hmm. There's so much judgment in the world. You know, it just, it makes me crazy. The hate, the judgment, you know, you're too fat, you're too tall, you're too short, you're this color. I mean, we need to be taking care of each other and helping each other and figuring these things out. They're very complex problems. And so how do we work together, you know, for that benefit? And it's what I call just being a good human, right?
100%. And I wish everyone shared that perspective. You know, I would add that, you know, when I see the divisiveness in politics, whether it's your country or mine, when there's shit like this happening every day and people that need help, right. And this is what the politicians should be protecting us from. This and so many other threats that are so much bigger than if the states are blue or red, you know?
I agree.
I don't know when that became the thing. That became the answer of it's got to be your color. There must be something more than that. And even hearing you describe there, you know, going between the work you do with veterans, the work you do with children, the work you do with these young men, there's this kind of shared commonality in the way you describe it of you're connecting to these people on a very, on a beautifully flat level, that everyone needs care. Everyone should be able to be vulnerable and ask for help. And everyone should have the opportunity to re-find joy and hope and what it means to look after that child in them. And that is irrespective of whatever age they come to your program, they need looking after.
Agreed. Yeah. And, you know, it's important that, so our services are always free or subsidized, right? Yeah, you know, for victims. But the way, the name of the organization is Ranch Hands Rescue. And the way that I define it as ranch is the animal portion, the special needs animals. Hands is our counseling program, which even though we specialize in children, that's 80% of the clients that we see. We still see adult sex trafficking victims, you know, women, veterans with severe PTSD, you know, the list just goes on and on because the program really works for anybody. And then Rescue is Bob's House of Hope, the first safe house in the country for young men that have been sex trafficked. And to your point, I think that we've, in trying to educate people, right, about the issues, especially that we're dealing with every day, it's okay, right? It's okay to talk to somebody about it. And it's okay to, if you don't understand, to tell people that you don't understand. But if we don't start talking about it, you know, in a more in-depth conversation, then we're going to continue to have the same problems that we've always had because you can't sweep it under the rug, right? Yeah. We have to bring it to the forefront.
Yeah, you don't make change by pretending the problems don't exist. Absolutely.
Right.
And on that note, then we'll start to wrap up. Is there anything else you want to share in terms of particular calls to action or ways people can learn more about the work and support it?
Sure. So I would say that, you know, we welcome the opportunity for people to join us in this fight. And so you can go to our website, sign up to be a volunteer, a distinguished mentor, a spokesperson around the world. There's all kinds of things that you can help us with. And we welcome the opportunity to work with anyone. And of course, you know, there's a huge financial responsibility here. So if anybody wants to donate to us, they can do that through our website as well, www.ranchhandsrescue.org.
Love that. I will go ahead and send over a donation after this because I know how much it all counts. And yeah, I'm spinning here of like, what more can I say? Because I think we've we've covered so much, and yet, you know, this is something I'm so passionate about. Yeah, it's a special conversation to get to connect with you and revisit. You know, I said to you off air, I genuinely think about that conversation with Landon and about your work all the time, you know, all the way from here in Dublin. And so, you know, you keep it up and you look after you too.
Well, thank you. You know, it's very, you're just a joy. Landon was so impressed with you. You really are, though. And I think, you know, when I look at your accomplishments and the things that you're doing in terms of educating people, it's, you should be very, very proud of it. I'm certainly proud to know you. Landon, you know, I tell people I never had a son, all right? If I was going to have a son, I'd want him to be just like Landon. And he's one of the most amazing young men that I've ever met and just a good, good person. And so I think that, you know, I always tell everybody the world needs more Landons. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, it does take all of us working together to share each other's mission and visions to really enact change and to help improve the lives of others. You know, this isn't complicated. We all want the same thing in life, right? We want to be happy. We want to have somebody to love us. We want to have, you know, a roof over our head, a nice car, a career. It's not complicated. Yeah. And there's
safety,
a lot of
love,
people,
friendship.
You know, right? Millions of people, right, that are struggling with that. And so I know you talk about boundaries a lot, and I'm very huge on boundaries and healthy coping mechanisms and teaching people how to do that in a space that is safe and what the differences are between healthy and unhealthy.
Mm-hmm. For sure. It's massive. And yeah, like you say, I'm in the same position. I get to learn things every day. And that is such a privilege. And I feel so delighted that I get that from mental health, a thing that for most of my life I didn't think was okay to talk about. And now I get to talk about and benefit from these conversations every day. And so this is episode 299. And it's so special. Wow. To chat to you.
Well, thank you. By the way, I went to your website. I love it. It's so hip and cool.
Thank you.
It really is. Very, very,
I designed it myself.
If I was young and hip and cool like you, I'd have a website like that too, but I'm not.
Thank you.
But yeah, I loved it. I went through it and looked at everything, and it's very, very impressive. So as I say, this is an honor. And if you get to the States, you have to come visit us.
Oh, I absolutely will. I'm already going through my head of how can I work with you more. And so for now, before we start going into a full business meeting, let's wrap up there. Thank you.
All righty.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shaped the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.